I want to return again to the theme of how the sense of self gets created, that it's not something intrinsic to the human experience, but it's rather it's something that's formed over and over. Last week we talked about this a little bit in terms of how our perception of any experience forms the basis for the mind to think about and then spin out in papancha around what we've perceived, and then having spun out in papancha, the perceptions and concepts come back to beset us in terms of past, present, and future. And that reflects the kind of stirring up of all the concerns about self expressed in the three times. Tonight I want to talk about the creation of self, but from a different angle, and that is the angle of the five aggregates. But in both approaches, and possibly one more talk next week, what I want to emphasize is how the self is not a kind of constant, ongoing, enduring thing, but rather is just a sense that gets created out of our own views and beliefs and volitional actions of mind. This formation of self is not a trivial thing. It is kind of a profound delusion that we operate under until we see through it. And at the very root of our sense of bondage and limitation. And when you think about it, the human situation is perplexing and confounding. You know? So it's not surprising that we've gotten caught and deluded. There is this interesting thing about embodied existence. Consciousness and this body have somehow come together. Looking out on the world, it seems like we are really separate. So what is this whole thing about coming into a body and then feeling because of this individuation that we are separate from everything? The problem is that we tend to take this separation as something absolute, as something finally real, but it's not. You know, a simple way to see through some of it is our bodies are separate, but our minds are not. You can feel someone else's love. You can feel their compassion. You can feel their anger. Our minds are not separate. At this moment, I'm part of your experience, and you're part of my experience. So we kind of go into one another. We make up part of one another. So this seeming separation catches us. It leaves us in a state of some sense of isolation, which brings about some anxiety and fear. And I think in our modern day and age, it's compounded because we've gotten separated from nature, and we've gotten separated even from human community. So the sense of isolation is even stronger for us. And therefore, I think more important that we understand this basic delusion around the seeming separation. I like to start by reflecting on this poem of Rumi's when he says, "Where did I come from? And what am I supposed to be doing here? I have no idea." I like the honesty of this. We don't, do we? We come into this world and we kind of wake up maybe when we're about 18 or 16 or 20 and we go, "What am I doing here? This world is mad. What should I do?" We don't know. And this is the mystery also. We don't really know how we got here and we don't know how we're going to exit. But in the meantime, here we are, and the sense of separation is really felt as a burden, as a source of fear and loneliness. I remember the first three-month course that I sat. Joseph was one of my teachers, and a friend was on the retreat, someone I got to know at the end of the retreat. And at one point in the retreat, she came up to Joseph, and I think she grabbed him in the front lobby, took him by the arm, and she had a real sense of urgency. I would almost say frenzy. And she said, "Joseph, why are we here?" And Joseph said, "Do you mean here on the retreat or or here at all?" And she said, "Why are we here at all?" And Joseph said very calmly, "Well, you're here because you wanted to see and hear and taste and touch and smell." And that calmed her down for a time. That is the classic Buddhist understanding. We didn't arrive here by accident. We got here because there were unfinished volitional formations from an earlier existence that propelled us onward with some kind of sense desire, an unfinished hunger for sense contact and sense pleasure. And that was the motive force that brought us into this particular existence. And of course, our culture celebrates this existence, doesn't it? Oh, you're so lucky to have been born, you know, especially at this time in civilization. You know, you're all so fortunate. But from a Buddhist point of view, birth is a little problematic. It's not all great news, because birth is what leads us into aging, sickness, death, the sense of separation, fear, loneliness, discontent, and so forth. But in our culture, it's just kind of, it's meant to be a source of joy. One of the great, I think, Dharma teachers of the last 50 years was an Indian teacher named Nisargadatta Maharaj. He lived in Bombay, died in 1981. So a number of people that I know got to meet him and receive teachings with him. He was very powerful. A lot of his, I think, best teachings were collected in a book called I Am That. So very recommended if you're interested in knowing more about him. And one of his comments was, "The desire for embodied existence is the root cause of all trouble." Yet here we are. And another corollary, another follow-up, all yogas have only one aim: to save you from the calamity of separate existence. So it's not necessarily that this birth has to continue to be problematic, but it's problematic if we believe in the separation that it seems to point to. We're misled by this seeming separate existence. The body is separate, some continuum in the mind is separate, but there are lots of ways we're very, very connected to one another and to nature. So based on this seeming sense of separation, we generate the sense of I. It becomes the center of the world for us. Everything revolves around me. It's so important that it ought to be discoverable. But have you ever found it? Isn't that a curious state of affairs? It's so central, but no one has ever found it. William James, the philosopher, commented, "When I search for myself, all I can find is a tickle at the back of my throat." And some of us come up with less than that. So Dalai Lama says, it's a sure sign of delusion when you think you can find something, but when you search for it, you actually can't. And the classic example in the text is that you're walking through the forest and you think you see a snake and you get very scared. But when you stop and look more closely, it's a piece of rope with different colored twine, you know, sort of a beige and a green and a red, and it looks like a snake, so you're frightened. But as soon as you correct your perception and see it as a piece of rope, the fear goes away. Similarly, it's said that when we perceive our situation clearly without attributing to it the sense of I, our fear goes away, and our sense of separation and isolation goes away. So this is an important area to understand. So we can start this evening to look a little bit more into this question of I and what it looks like, feels like, how it comes about. So I want to start with some simple questions. These are not tricks. If I ask you how tall you are, that easy to answer? You know your height, right? Like, I would say I'm 5'10". And if, you know, if you're from Europe, you might say you're 160 centimeters or whatever. Really clear. But what does the I mean there? We really mean the body, don't we? The body is 5'10" tall. Are your thoughts 5'10"? Are your emotions 160 centimeters? No. So here we say I and we mean body. We're equating I and body. So I am the body. All right, let me ask you a different question. What color are your eyes? Well, that's very easy. I'd say my eyes are brown. Oh, so now I'm no longer the body. I'm not saying I am my eyes. Now I'm the owner of the body. These are my eyes, so I own the body. So which are you? Are you your body or are you the owner of the body? You can't be both, can you? That's not logical. Well, that's a confusion. You could say the same thing about emotion. Sometimes we say, I'm happy or I'm sad. So here we're equating I with the emotions. So basically, I am the emotion. But at other times, we'll talk about my joys and my sorrows. So now you're somebody who owns emotions, who has feelings. So which is it? Or another way that we experience the self, the I, it feels like, and sometimes this is the most convincing, it feels like I is located in the center of the head, right behind the eyes. And the eye is kind of looking out and experiencing all those sights and sounds and smells and tastes, like there's a central observer here. And it's taking everything in. But it's separate from the experience. It receives it all. And then that observer is sort of associated with a command and control center. I decide. And I am the master of my fate. That's right behind the eyes. It was so interesting when I did a lot of body meditation. I really explored that space behind the eyes. I never found a capital I there. But it's one of the, I'd say, deepest senses we have of where we are and what that thing is. So these are five different ways that we feel the I. They can't all be right, can they? And in fact, they're all deluded. The Buddha put it this way, in whatever way they conceive of self, the fact is ever other than that. Or one of my teachers put it more bluntly. He said, everything you think is wrong. Where it concerns the self, that's pretty much what the Buddha is saying. Whatever you think about the self is wrong. Because we can't verify it experientially. We can't find anything that needs to be labeled an I or a self. There's no empirical basis for this designation. It's just a fiction that's been created by our thoughts. So if it's just a fiction, what's the truth? What's real? So the Buddha talked about this often. Where we see a person, I think he saw differently. There's this great passage from the Visuddhimagga, which is a 5th century commentarial text, 6th century, sorry, commentarial text that talks about this misperception. In that text, they say, if a butcher who's very skilled in their trade is carving up the carcass of a cow, as they're cutting it apart, are they saying, cow, cow, cow? No, because they know it too well. As they're cutting it up, they're saying rump, sirloin, tenderloin, ribs. In the same way, the Visuddhimagga said, one who has carefully explored their own mind-body process doesn't say human being. They see in more detail the components that make us up. So what did the Buddha see when he talked about what makes up a being, what makes up our human experience? He mostly described it in two ways, one of two ways. The first is a scheme we've used a lot in the retreat so far, and that is the six sense doors. That our human experience, all that we could say, all that we are, the totality of what human means and includes, is sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and mind objects, and the knowing of them. So those are the six sense doors, and the knowing of events at those doors. That's one way the Buddha described the human experience. And it's complete. Describes everything that happens within our field of experience. It's convenient for us because it maps nicely onto our meditation instructions. Our instructions have kind of been along these lines. Notice body, notice sounds, notice thoughts and feelings, notice sights, notice tastes, and so on. The Buddha used this schema of the six senses when he was teaching how to cut through craving, primarily. So he put a lot of emphasis on how we relate to pleasant experiences at the six senses. So understanding how to let go of craving is a central point of the teaching, and the six senses was the scheme that he used for that teaching again and again. But there's another scheme that he used just about as often, which takes the same totality and just cuts it up differently, just slices it differently. And that schema is called the five aggregates. That's what I want to talk about tonight. This teaching he used for a different purpose. This was to cut through wrong view. Not so much cutting through craving based on the pleasant, it's to cut through wrong view, which is how do we generate the sense of self when there isn't really one there. So that's what I want to explore this evening, is how does the model of the five aggregates help us see this generation of self again and again. When you first hear the teaching on the five aggregates, there could be a little resistance because it sounds kind of intellectual. One person said, oh, I don't really want to learn that Abhidharma stuff. You know, that's for somebody else. This is not in the Abhidharma. This goes all through the suttas, all through the direct teachings of the Buddha. For me, it was not just an intellectual investigation, but some years ago, about 18 years ago, one of my older sisters died when she was relatively young and in relatively good health. She died suddenly and unexpectedly. She was living in a different state, and I had talked to her about a week before she died. She was a strong personality. She had a great sense of humor, a lot of love, and a lot of warmth. I felt very close to her. And her death was a shock, a total shock to me. And so not only was there a sense of loss, and I grieved for a few months, but also I realized I was really perplexed by it. Because the last time I had contact with her, she was so alive and so vital and felt so solid to me. And when she died, I couldn't understand how she had gone from something so solid to not being there anymore. In trying to understand what happened, what I used for investigation was this model of the five aggregates. And better than any other scheme, it helped me kind of come to terms with what's here when we're alive. And what is it that separates or goes apart when we die? So through this, I came to my own much better understanding of the process of living and dying. And also, I just felt a better understanding of what constitutes a being and why it doesn't make sense to cling to it. If we open ourselves to seeing in this way, seeing a being, seeing ourselves, seeing others, according to this model of the five aggregates, we start to see the way the Buddha saw. And by seeing the way the Buddha saw, it leads to more freedom in our own hearts and minds. So this is not just an intellectual exercise, but it's really meant to be an investigation that can lead to an unburdening of the heart. And that's the way that it's felt for me. So this word aggregate in the Pali is a translation of the term khanda. The Sanskrit is skanda, so you might hear it either way. I don't like the translation of aggregate, but it's one of those translations that came a long time ago and we're kind of stuck with it. Aggregate reminds me of building roads. You throw in a little asphalt, throw in a little gravel, a few rocks, and you've got an aggregate. And it sounds too technical and kind of off-putting. So sometimes the Pali word was very common. It meant something like a collection, a heap, or a bundle. So sometimes these are called the five heaps. I can do. But actually the translation I like is kinds of stuff. And I think that's the best. These are the five kinds of stuff that make up you and make up me. So what are these kinds of stuff? When you look within, like a skilled butcher would look, what are these kinds of stuff that make us up? They are material form, feeling tone, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. So I want to go through these all a little bit so that we get a sense of what makes us up. The first one is form. The Pali word is rupa. The correct terminology probably is material form, but I might just say form to make it short. This word rupa is sometimes used to mean body. So body is certainly part of material form, or you could say matter. Common parlance in Asia is that this statue behind me of the Buddha is called a Buddha rupa, a form of the Buddha, the body, almost the body of the Buddha. Form is also used to refer to the realm of seeing. So the material world that we can see, it all is included under this term rupa, but it's broader than just sights. It's really matter and the interaction between it. So, for instance, anything that has mass is part of rupa or form, but also the way they interact. So if I hit this mass with one other mass and that makes a sound, that's also part of rupa. If I take a clump of couscous and put it on my tongue and that generates the flavor orange, that flavor is also part of material form. So material form is basically matter in all its manifestations, which means it's the five physical sense elements. Sight, sound, smell, taste, and sensations all make up this first aggregate of form. So, the simple example, when that sound arises and reaches your hearing, that sound is considered form. It's in the matter aggregate. Okay. So the whole physical world, the whole of materiality, the five physical sense experiences are included in this first aggregate of form. That means that the other four aggregates are all non-physical, therefore mental. So the other four aggregates kind of make up the scope of mind. And so when somebody asks you in Buddhism, what's included in mind, the simplest answer is it's these other four aggregates: feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness. So feeling is the term vedana, or feeling tone, that we've talked about quite a bit. It's the quality in every sense contact of its being pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. And Carol gave instructions on this last week. It's important because vedana is the quality in the mind on which greed, aversion, and delusion form in reaction. When there's a pleasant feeling, greed tends to form if we're not mindful. When there's an unpleasant feeling tone, aversion tends to form if we're not mindful. And when there's a neutral feeling tone, delusion or spacing out or forgetting tends to form if we're not mindful. We've spent some time with Vedana in the meditation instructions. I think you're fairly familiar with that. I just want to underscore that it is in the mental aggregates, not in the physical aggregates, which means it's not a function of the physical arising. Like this bell, when we hear the bell, most of us would experience that as a pleasant sound. A, it's Japanese, you know, they've been making bells for centuries, it's a culture that loves silence, they really know how to make beautiful sounds with their bells. So the Japanese did a great job on this one, it's a pleasant sound. But also, for us, it has specially pleasurable connotations. It means the sitting's over, so, you know, apart from the lunch bell, maybe this is the most pleasant sound of the day. So generally, we experience this sound as pleasant, but somebody else might experience it as not pleasant. Or if I hit it too hard, it might be experienced as not pleasant. So it is not, the pleasant is not intrinsic to the physical sound, but it's how it lands in our conditioned mind. Different of us might experience it differently. And there's a story that illustrates this. There was a 7-Eleven in Southern California that was having a problem. The problem was that drug dealers were doing their business in the parking lot. And because they were all hanging out there, ordinary customers didn't feel comfortable parking and walking by to get into the store. So the store manager would call the police. The police would come and the drug dealers would leave and the parking lot would clear out. But as soon as the police went away, they came back and were dealing because the parking lot was well lit and it was in a central location. So the manager got tired of calling the police all the time and he thought, I've got to figure out a different way to deal with this. So he thought some music might do the trick. So he started playing through the store's speaker system selections from Mantovani. So I don't know if you know Mantovani. He was a leader of an orchestra in the 50s and 60s. He kind of would play sentimental movie soundtracks with all these swelling strings in the orchestra, sort of very emotional movie music. And I grew up on that kind of music because my mother loved Mantovani. So I actually have very pleasant associations with Mantovani, even though it gets a little too close to Muzak. For me, the basic association is pleasurable. I kind of like Mantovani. But the drug dealers didn't. So when the 7-Eleven started blasting out Mantovani, they got so annoyed they moved elsewhere to do what they needed to do. And then the parking lot was clear. So even though I might like Mantovani, not everybody does. It was experienced as very irritating to other people. So it's really how our mind takes it in and how our conditioning relates with it. And I think Carol mentioned that in Utejaniya's explanation, feeling almost becomes a verb. We feel into the impact in our consciousness, and we feel whether it's going to be pleasant or unpleasant. It's almost an active feeling out, and we turn it into something pleasant or unpleasant. So sometimes you might experience it like that. Often we just experience it as, this is what my mind feels this thing to be. So the next aggregate, the second mental aggregate, is perception, sanya. That's what we talked about last time with the Honeyball Sutta, how perceptions underlie papancha, or the basis of our spinning out. And we talked about how intrinsic to the eye door is just patches of form and color, shape and color, and that perception is the faculty of mind that organizes those into recognizable objects like women and men and zabatons and lights, windows. This seems like almost unbelievable that it takes another faculty of mind to know what we're seeing, but there's an incident from Oliver Sacks's career that really illustrates this. He's a neurologist and has written a lot of interesting books around patients that he's seen. So he was working with this one patient who I think had had sight early in life but had lost it as a young child. And then in midlife, they determined that his sight could be restored through an operation. So an eye surgeon was brought in to operate. Sachs was consulting as the neurologist. They did the operation on the fellow, and Sachs was by his bedside when the bandages were taken off his eyes, along with the surgeon and the man's family. And everybody expected that the bandages were going to come off and there'd be this great expression of joy on the man's face, and he would go, "I can see! I can see!" It didn't happen like that. They took the bandages off, and Sachs reported that there was just this kind of puzzled expression on the man's face. And the surgeon saw the same thing and sort of leaned in and said, "Well?" And then the man later reported that what he saw was just a jumble of meaningless color and forms and blurs. And when the surgeon said, "Well," he recognized the voice. And from that, he deduced that this blob that was moving closer and closer to his eye must be the surgeon's face. But he couldn't recognize it as that at all. And so he didn't have an experience of seeing things the way that you and I do. All he saw were mystifying patches of color and shape and movement. He had to train to recognize what these things represented because his brain had missed the wiring that would have happened at, you know, over many, many years of development. And as the story turned out, Sachs followed him for a while. He never got very good at perceiving in the visual field. It was maybe a little too late for his brain to put all that together. He became functional in the world, but he never really became easy in the world. His perception didn't quite come back together. So perception is a very powerful and kind of underappreciated part of life. And when we perceive things that are meaningful for us, emotional results happen. I'll give you a simple example. When I say empty chair, does that sound very charged? It's nothing, right? The chair is empty. It's nothing. But I've had different experiences with empty chairs. So if I go into a movie theater, and it's one of those comfortable ones with stadium seats, empty chair is just empty chair. Can stay empty, it can get filled, I don't really care. Very neutral. Uncharged relation to empty chair. If I'm at a meeting or a conference and we're having meals together, I go into the lunchroom, for example, and maybe I'm the first one in because I try to be. I sit down at one of the chairs, and most of the room is empty, so that I have empty chairs on both sides of me, and other people start coming in, and then the room starts filling up. If my chairs don't start filling up when the rest of the room is filling up, then I start to feel, what's wrong? Why isn't anybody sitting by me? Doesn't anybody like me? Are people trying to avoid me? You know, won't somebody please come and sit in my empty chair? So I look at my empty chair and it's a source of anxiety because it says something, I'm not lovable. So I just, you know, I sort of start praying that somebody will come and sit in the empty chair. So the perception of empty chair now has a charge which is connected to my self-view. Empty chair means I'm not lovable. That's just a self-view. Then, if I'm on an airplane flying from San Francisco to Boston, I try to get on the plane early also. So I settle in my aisle seat if I have one. And then somebody might come and sit in the window seat. That's okay, you know, three seats across. And then other passengers are boarding, and the seat next to me doesn't get filled up. And I start off and I'm just feeling a lot of compassion for all the people coming down the aisle. Everybody's stressed when they fly these days. Mother's coming on board with two kids and her baggage and all their teddy bears. And I just feel everybody's stressed the way I was. Then the flight really starts to fill up. There are not many empty seats left, but mine is still empty next to me. then I start feeling slightly hostile to everybody who's walking down the aisle because they are a threat to taking away my empty seat, which would be so much more comfortable for the 6 hours of flying time. So now there's desire around that empty seat, or aversion, desire to have it empty, aversion to somebody coming. So in the first case, the perception of empty chair was, I want somebody to sit there. Now the perception of empty chair is, I don't want somebody to sit there. So these simple features of the world can come to have a lot of charge for us. Perception is a big thing in Zen training. You've probably heard this, you know. And this is related to having you look at things fresh. Like, you know, if you hadn't been in the meditation hall for 3 weeks already and you just wandered upon this thing, would you know what it was? I mean, it certainly could be a bell, but couldn't it also be a monk's bowl? It's not a bad size for a monk's bowl. Wouldn't it make a nice planter or flower pot? If you turned it upside down and put it on a statue, wouldn't it be a nice hat of some sort? Quite a fashionable little chapeau of some kind. So Zen plays a lot of games with this kind of thing. You know, are you really seeing it as it is? Are you seeing it through your conventions? And they would say things like, you know, what is this? If you say it's a striker, I will hit you. But if you say it's not a striker, I will hit you also. So what I learned from that is I better not sit Zen or I'd get hit a lot. So it's partly why I'm in Vipassana. In the 1970s, as people were getting into Buddhist practice, at one point, these two great spiritual teachers happened to be in the Boston area at the same time. And some friends thought it would be a good idea to bring them together, let these two highly enlightened beings meet, and see what kind of, you know, wonderful rapport there will be. It didn't necessarily work out that way. So the teachers were Sansanim, who was a Korean Zen master, and Kalu Rinpoche, who was a very highly regarded Tibetan Lama and monk. So they met in the home of some friends in Cambridge. They were served tea and some refreshments. And then, you know, the friends thought there would be a really beautiful Dharma dialogue as they recognized each other's attainment. So Sansanim began the dialogue, and he picked up an orange and held it out to the Rinpoche and said, what is this? Sort of very intensely. And Kalu Rinpoche just sort of sat there and looked at him and kept doing his beads, you know, reciting a mantra. Just very cooled out, smiling, didn't say anything. And in Zen, you're supposed to be quick with answering, you know, your koan. So Sansanim did it again. He held out, what is this? And Kalu just sat there, turned to his translator and asked, don't they have oranges in Korea? So, the Dharma dialogues don't always go the way we expect. So, here, when the bell is rung, we hear the sound, that's form. It has a pleasant feeling. We recognize it as not only a bell, but bell to end the sitting, and that's the factor of perception. The next category is mental formations, and these are the whole world of mind states, thoughts, feelings, and kind of also the movement of mind states into action, volitional actions. So we've spent quite a bit of time on these also in the instructions, both the beautiful emotions, love and compassion, happiness, joy, the refined meditative states of calm, of concentration, of rapture, of one-pointedness, as well as the difficult emotional states, fear, anger, loneliness, jealousy, and so forth. One of the things we start to understand is that because greed, aversion, and delusion are strategies for relating to the world, so also these compounds of greed, aversion, and delusion are to some degree volitional. So these mental formations are sometimes called volitional formations, and it's important to see that even though we feel sometimes like a passive victim of our emotions, in fact, somewhere they began from impulses that came out of our own will. So we start looking into qualities like anger, the will to push aside, fear, the will to pull back, desire, the will to pull in what's pleasant, and so on. We see that there is volition at the bottom of these movements. So we can connect with that, and we understand our they are expressions of what we want in different ways. And then the wholesome qualities also express a volition, wholesome formations of generosity, of kindness, of love and compassion are also expressing our wish, in this case, to help. So when we hear the bell, we might have volitional formations or mental formations at that time. Often there's the sense, hearing the bell at the end of a sitting, isn't there a sense of relief? And you might say ease. And then the thought might arise, oh, I could sit forever. So those formations, relief, ease, the thought, these are all examples of mental formations or volitional formations. And the last of the mental aggregates is consciousness. This is a really interesting one. Consciousness is that factor of mind that reveals all the experience to us. You could say holds it. The basic kind of knowing or cognizance of bare sense data. Preconceptual. It's not verbal. It's just receiving the sense data of color or a sound or a mood. So it's said that consciousness and the object arise together. And if you look into your experience closely, I think you'll get a feeling for this. That when you're, for instance, feeling the rise of an in-breath, the rise is a physical sensation, but consciousness is knowing it. If a corpse had, you know, if someone pressed on the chest of a corpse and the belly rose and air came into the lungs, the physical experience in the body might be the same, but there would be no knowing of it. The fact that we're awake and alive means there is knowing of our experience, and that's consciousness. So the way I like to think of it is that there are two things there. There's the experience and the knowing. They're together, but there are two aspects of it. One experience, but two aspects. And it's kind of like, how can there be one experience and two aspects? It's like, if I hold the bell up like this, is it round or is it black? It's both, isn't it? It just depends which you focus on, the color or the shape. So in the experience of an in-breath, you can focus on the physical characteristics or you can focus on the knowing, your receiving of that. The knowing is the consciousness. So these are the aggregates, form, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness. But why is it freeing to see like this? Because there's an important word missing from here. And the missing word is I. In this description, which is complete, of our whole human experience, there is no need to include I or self. All these five components that make us up all operate under their own laws. They're all part of their own nature. There's physical nature, which we understand. This body is physical nature. Ajahn Buddhadasa, whom Greg mentioned a few days ago, said something like that. He said, this body came from nature, has never departed from nature, and belongs to nature. Give it back to nature. That will be a great relief for you. So this body operates under its own laws of physical nature. Similarly, all the mental events, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness operate according to their natural laws. So all these things are going on. There is no I in the center to whom they're happening. There is no agent who's pulling all the strings. They all have their own natural unfolding. So, how does the sense of self then get created? So there's a great sutta that explains this, where the Buddha described it in this context. He called this sense of self personality view, sakkaya ditti. That is the view that there is a person here. You could say the personhood view. How does this view get created? This is a discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's number 109, called Discourse on a Full Moon Night. And the Buddha explained it in this way. An untaught ordinary person, this is a little complex, so please pay close attention. An ordinary person regards form, so here's rupa, he's talking about rupa in the five aggregates, regards form as self, or self as possessing form, or form as in self, or self as in form. And then he repeats that for the other four mental aggregates. So there are four formulations with the body, with form or the body, and there are four more formulations for each of the other four mental aggregates, giving 20 ways altogether that we construct this idea of self. So really briefly, one regards form as self. This is the view, I am the body, which we talked about earlier. Or self as possessing form. I own a body. This is my body. Or form as in self. That would be, the body is part of me. I'm bigger than the body, but the body is part of me. The body is in me. So for instance, if you identify with consciousness, you could say, oh, my consciousness is very big and the body is in that. Or self as in form. That would be, I live inside the body. And this is kind of that sense of the observer behind the eyes. I dwell inside the body. So this is the process we call identification. Identification means that we take a part of our experience, and it can be at any of the five aggregates, and we claim it as self. Either we are it, or we own it, or we're in it, or it's in us. We claim it as self in some way. This is the only way the sense of I gets generated. It's not intrinsic. It's not necessary to describe any of our experience, but this is how we bring it into being. For example, we might say, I have a pain in my right knee. Could we say that without using the word I or my? We could, couldn't we? An unpleasant sensation is arising in the knee. We could even say the right knee, but we don't have to call it my right knee. And we've just taken the word I out of there. Or we could say, I'm really feeling afraid right now. What's another way to say that meditatively? Fear is arising as a mind state. So maybe this sense of I isn't really needed to describe our own inner experience in any way. Maybe it can all be described without claiming it as I or mine. Of course, the use of I and you and he and she, these are useful social distinctions. You know, when you go to bed tonight, you want to know which is your room. Because if you go and try to lie down in somebody else's room, there's going to be a problem. So amongst us, these designations are useful, but they're only conventional. We don't need them in describing our own experience to ourselves. Only useful for social intercourse, which means the I is extra. It's extra and unnecessary. This is the beauty of Vipassana practice. When we start seeing what moment to moment is happening is just sounds and sights and sensations and moods and thoughts, we are seeing things without the overlay of self. The more we let ourselves fall into that stream of seeing in that way, the more we're moving away from the habituated formation of self, which is unnecessary. So the more we surrender to just seeing what is moment after moment, we're not even trying, but we're taking a little of the habit of self out of our understanding. And that's also how the noting can be a great support, because the noting is just naming the experience so simply. So then we want to know, well, why is it problematic to claim it as self? You know, why shouldn't I claim it as I? Okay? So one of the things that's intrinsic in this false concept of I think I mentioned last week that we build up an inner sense of I because we intuit that nothing outside is lasting. But maybe we can create some continuity through this inner construction and the I will last. So very important in the concept of self is that it endures over time. This is an integral part of the assumption of I. You can check this out, you know, rather simply. If you don't think that you are enduring over time, you would have no fear of dying. If you think it's somebody else who's going to die one day, no problem. But because we feel, oh, that's going to be me on that deathbed, death presents a threat. Presents a fear. So if you explore this, I think you'll see it. Integral to the sense of I is enduring over time. And as we see, until from now till the day we die, we think of the I continuing. So the Buddha continued in this discourse, and he started to question the bhikkhus, and he asked them, is form permanent or impermanent? And of course they answered, impermanent, venerable sir, as we all know. Is what is impermanent lastingly happy or ultimately unsatisfactory? So this is a key understanding. If something is impermanent, does it have the ability to give a lasting happiness? Or if we're building our happiness on that, does it ultimately turn out to be unsatisfactory? It's unsatisfactory if it changes, isn't it? If our happiness is based on it and it changes, it's not ultimately a lasting happiness. So the monk said, unsatisfactory, venerable sir. Is what is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine. This I am. This is myself. This is an important question. Are we basing our sense of self and therefore lasting happiness on things that are subject to change? And the truth is, we do. Whatever we claim in the world, including this body, possessions, friends, all are subject to disappearing, to going away. So we're claiming things as self, as I and mine, that can't last. Similarly, for the other four mental aggregates, we're doing the same thing. So then the Buddha was asked, how does one see with wisdom? So that in regard to this body with its consciousness, there is no I-making and my-making. This is a beautiful question. And one of the beauties of this question is this phrase, I-making and my-making. The Pali is ahankara and mamankara. And this points to exactly what we do. The I's not intrinsic, but we keep making it. We keep making I and we keep making mine by claiming these changing bits of experience for ourselves. So how do we see the body and its consciousness in such a way that we don't make I and we don't make my? So the Buddha replied, therefore, all form should be seen as it really is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. Similarly, for feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness. This is almost a meditation instruction. when you're connecting with any of your sense experience, what if you were to say about that experience, not me, not mine, not who I am? Would that alter your relationship to it? Would that strengthen mindfulness in relation to the clear seeing of what is arising and passing? It can. So I encourage you to play just with this simple formulation, not me, not mine, not who I am. And see if that helps with the understanding. See if that helps with the sense of freedom in relation. There was a very brilliant philosopher named Nagarjuna who came about 500 years after the Buddha, and for my taste, the second most impressive thinker in the whole history of Buddhism. And he put it this way, what is inside is me. What is outside is mine. That's really pithy, isn't it? What is inside is me, right? The body, thoughts, and feelings we take to be me. What is outside is mine. You know, I'll claim my possessions, my money, my car, my friends, etc. When these thoughts cease, kilesas stop, and freedom dawns. When this claiming of I and my stops, kilesa, defilement, cease, and freedom dawns. Try it and see for yourself. When we see clearly that there is only form, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness coming and going all the time, and there's no investment of I, then there's no problem. I just want to close with a story from the suttas. This is from the Udana. And one of the pithiest teachings in the whole of the Pali Canon, the story of Bahiya. Bahiya was living at the time of the Buddha. He was living in the south of India by the sea. He was a spiritual practitioner of some renown. He had followers, he was well supported, he was well loved in his community. But Bahiya had a question. His question was, am I really enlightened? That question should have been a clue, because he wasn't. And he said, am I even on a path to enlightenment? He wasn't sure. So, as the story goes, a deva came down to him and did him a big favor and said, Bahiya, you are not enlightened. And you are not even on the path to enlightenment. Bahiya was discouraged, shocked. But he said to the deva, is there anyone alive who is really awakened? And the deva said, yes, there is Gautama Buddha, who has fully awakened and is proclaiming the teaching by which he came to awakening. And he is now living in northern India in the town called Savatthi. So Bahiya resolved then and there to travel to meet Gautama Buddha as quickly as he could. So he walked a long way. It said he didn't pause more than to sleep overnight. He was just walking every day until he reached him. He got to the town of Savatthi, asked for the whereabouts of the Buddha. He was told he was in the village wandering for alms. So he immediately went and he saw this very noble being, dignified bearing, peaceful, calm, sort of regal composure. And he went up, approached and bowed to his feet and asked if he was the one known as the Buddha. And the Buddha acknowledged that he was. And Bahiya said, I've traveled a long way to see you. Please teach me your Dhamma so that I can understand. And the Buddha said, Bahiya, I'm collecting my alms food right now. This is not a good time. Please come back and see me another time. And Bahiya said, Venerable Sir, none of us knows how long you will live or how long I will live. Please, for my welfare, teach me the Dhamma so that I may understand. And the Buddha again denied him. So Bahiya asked a third time, Please, we don't know how long you will live or I will live. So the third time the Buddha relented, said, Very well, Bahiya, I will give you this teaching in brief. And this is what he told him. This is how you should train. In the scene, let there be just the scene. In the heard, let there be just the heard. In the sensed, let there be just the sensed. In the cognized, let there be just the cognized. Then there will be no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, then you will be neither here, nor there, nor in between. This, just this, is the end of suffering. And Bahia, who was very ripe through his prior spiritual development, heard that teaching, immediately understood, and was fully awakened. This happens in many of the stories in the suttas. One person, 50 people, 500 people get awakened from one teaching. Bahia was fully awakened. The Buddha continued on his alms round. Bahia, 1 hour later, was walking through a field where a cow was protecting her calf, was threatened by Bahia, charged him, gored him, and killed him. So 1 hour after getting this brief teaching, Bahia had died. So his words, "Who knows how long you will live or I will live," were very prophetic. But before his death, he had understood fully all he needed to come to awakening, and he was freed. So let's just sit together for a few moments, please. Then there will be no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, then you will be neither here, nor there, nor in between. This, just this, is the end of suffering.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.